The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have
they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to the Sunday afternoon Space Show program that, of course, is California time. I am your host, David Livingston, and great to be here. Gorgeous day in the San Francisco Bay Area. I hope wherever you are, it is equally as nice. So let me run through the announcements. We do have an open lines program today, so anything that's on your mind, space-related, science-related, STEM-related, we want to hear from you. And as always, telephones work a lot better on open lines than email, but both are welcome. Right now, the toll-free line is disconnected on purpose, and I will tell you when I turn it back on, and we're ready to take your calls. But do jot down our toll-free number. It is 1-866-687-7223, and email is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. Couple of quick announcements, general announcements, and then we'll go to the specific program announcements. So our website is thespaceshow.com. There is a comprehensive newsletter on the website over on the right side, and it is uploaded after the Sunday show, and it will tell you what's planned for the week on the Space Show. And then on the far right side of the homepage is our menu, one of the menu bars. And if you scroll down to upcoming shows, you will see all of the programs for the coming week. And remember, you can start posting comments or asking questions or putting material on the blog as soon as the show is listed in that upcoming show category. We'll be able to present that information during the live show to our guest. And, of course, that is also our blog. There is also a menu in the upper left-hand corner of our website, so there are links there to other websites that will interest you and to other information. Under the support menu is our logoware store at Cafe Press, all with our new Space Show logo on it. We have lots of new items that we didn't have before, so check it out. Hopefully you'll find some items of interest. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to send me an email. And everything we do on our website is archived, so you can easily download the shows very quickly if you have high-speed internet or listen to them on the show. Do remember some of the really old archive shows have strange time sequences listed on the browser. Ignore those. That is something that still has to be fixed. I'm waiting for Spencer to take care of that. But that all of the show is there, so if you go to play it, the time sequence may be wrong depending on your browser, but all of the data on the show is there. And we'll keep you posted on that as we continue to go in toward the period where we're going to make those repairs. And also keep in mind that we are copyrighted and trademarked. You do have permission to download our programs and share them with people, or you can just share the URL with people. That's a lot easier. There are a couple of rules. One is don't do anything commercial with our programs. Don't clip or edit or, you know, make cuts of any parts of the shows and then put them up on YouTube or any other website. And then written transcripts are not permitted even if they're for your own use. Please read our full copyright statement. It is at the bottom of every page of our website, thespaceshow.com, and also it's at the bottom of the page of every one of our parents' websites. Pages 1GiantLeapFoundation.org. And we podcast with Gigadial.net. We thank Andrew for his service. And regarding podcasting, I have heard last night from a listener who has an iPhone 6S that he has been having podcasting issues since June 13th. I only heard about it last night. If any of you are having podcasting issues again, please let me know. They're very hard to troubleshoot. I do know, as I have posted on the Space Show announcement blog many, many times, that the Apple app is really terrible and causes a lot of these programs. So if you are using an iPhone and you're having problems, I'd totally recommend going to the App Store and downloading the free Overcast app. It works really great, and it works when the Apple app does not work. I do note that Apple is upgrading their operating system again. We're soon going to get iOS 10, and maybe Apple will fix their podcasting app problems in iOS 10, but your guess is as good as mine on that. Other ways people have tried to solve the problem is to uninstall the app, reboot their phone, install it, set up the account again, and see if that helps. And sometimes we have a problem in an archived program on Gigadial, and we have to go in and find that problem and then fix it. But usually when that happens, the podcasts aren't happening on Overcast or any other service as well. And that doesn't seem to be the case with the latest call for attention that I got last night. But if you are having podcast problems with your smartphone apps, please get a hold of me, and I'll do my best to see if we can figure out what's going on and troubleshoot those problems. We do have sponsors for our website, and again, I urge you from time to time to click on the banner ads that go across our homepage. We would not be able to do those shows without the sponsors, and we need them. And by the way, do remember that we are a 501c3 nonprofit with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. So if you do donate to us, and it is your contributions that keep us on the air, and you pay federal U.S. taxes, you get a tax deduction for your gift. And the same is true for those of you who pay California taxes, as we're a California public benefit corporation. But for the first segment of today's program, we are brought to you by Orbital ATK, the global leader in aerospace and defense technology, and the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defensive programs. And then also for the first segment, we're brought to you by the Integrated Space Plan by Integrated Space Analytics. This is a highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming a spacefaring race. See how technologies and destinations build upon one another. Explore hundreds of individual elements in more detail. You can order your own full-color poster. It comes in two sizes. Go to their website, which is thespaceplan.com. It's a useful and inspiring tool that should be on the wall for everyone serious about space development. Again, thespaceplan, all one word, .com. And now I have a couple of announcements. I'm going to lead off with a really terrible announcement, and this one has been really bothering me since I found out about it last night, and that is that we have lost a space show guest and friend of mine, Dr. Molly McCauley, who was a noted space economist, brilliant lady, great sense of humor, wonderful friend, was murdered Friday night, walking her dogs in the Roland Park area of Baltimore, Maryland. And she was stabbed to death. They did find her and got her to the hospital alive, but apparently the doctors were not able to save her life, and she did die at the hospital. And this is really a tragic waste and a loss. Molly was a great person, and as I said, if you ever got to meet her in person, she was friendly and fun, and that wonderful sense of humor, dog lover like so many of us on the space show, a great economist, and her shows will hopefully live forever. She was not a guest as often as I would have liked her to have been, but I did remain in touch with her over the years from time to time, and she will be missed on so many different levels, and how senseless to kill her. As far as I know from the articles I've read, the police don't have any information on what happened or why or anything like that. And it's just been gut-wrenching to lose her like this. And I'm dedicating today's show in her memory. So today's space show is in the memory of Molly McCauley. For those of you that are listening that may be in the Baltimore area, perhaps you've been hearing about it in the news or reading about it, or you know something additional to what I've been able to quickly summarize, feel free to call on open lines today and tell us about Molly. And if you don't live in Baltimore, but you knew Molly and you worked with her, or you remember her space shuttle programs from several years ago, and you feel like offering her a tribute or something, don't hesitate to call. This show today is in memory of Dr. Molly McCauley. And again, such a sad, sad waste. And, you know, it doesn't have anything to do with the space show, but I have to tell you, something is so terribly, terribly wrong in this country with murders and killing and crime and death and divisions. And it just seems to be getting worse, not better. And, you know, I have, you know, me, I'm cynical as hell about our politicians. So I have zero faith in any of our political so-called leaders who I think are bogus to help resolve things and unite us or heal things. I just don't see it. And as far as our two presidential candidates go, America has seen better, let me put it that way. So I don't know. I'm very upset about the loss of Molly, and all I can do is say that and put the show out today in her memory. So another thing I wanted to talk about, the Washington Post ran an article a few days ago, and this is considered general media, it's not space media, about the mysterious eye disease plaguing astronauts. So we have actually talked about this several times on the space show, about the eye disease that mostly male astronauts are showing up as having, and it might affect them in long-duration spaceflight. So I know many of you dismiss these kinds of articles and research papers and advocate taking the risk and moving forward, and you don't pay a whole lot of attention to it. So for those of you who feel that way about risk and who can succinctly, with some articulation, express yourself, I suggest you find the Washington Post article and put some comments in on their comment section. The last time I checked it early this morning, California time, there were about 100-plus comments on the article. So I would urge you, if you feel strongly about this, read the article, obviously, and then post a comment on it and make people know that you are from within the space community and you believe you know what you're talking about, and say what's on your mind about it. This is a way to reach a lot of people. I don't dismiss these things willy-nilly, but I know many of you do, and many of you are ready to argue to the death about taking a lot more risk and not paying attention to things like this. So this is a golden opportunity for you to reach lots and lots of new people for your ideas, because the Washington Post is hardly a space cadet or space enthusiast publication. I've already commented about keeping us posted on podcasts. I do want to let you know, and again remind you, that we have a space show blog set up for announcements, the announcement blog, and it is on our home page. And you can see there many of the older posts about the podcast problem, and if you're an iPhone user, getting a hold of the Overcast app, because it works so much better than the iPhone app. But get in the habit of checking that announcement blog to see if anything has ever been posted about what it is that you're writing about or the problem that you may be having. And that blog is actually the old Space Show blog, which is now the announcement blog. And I do put comments up about things that are happening, you know, from power outages to podcast problems. So check it out. Also, if you go over to the right menu bar, all the way to the right side, and scroll down, listener voices are there. So remember, this was a perk with the Space Show's new website on Indiegogo. And we have a few of you who have given us your message that you were allowed to put up and then change it quarterly if you wanted to. And that program runs for a year, but only a few of you have done it, and only one of you has ever changed your message. And many others took out the perk. You donated money based on that perk, but you haven't done it. And many of you have also taken out perks for co-hosting a space show and doing other things, and you haven't done that either. And the year is over half through. So this is at a loss to me. I've sent out email reminders. I talk about it on the show. And I guess y'all aren't interested in doing what it is you subscribe to vis-a-vis the perks for our Indiegogo program. But we want you to use those perks. We want you to co-host the show. We want you to have listener voices going. We would like to see all of this fully utilized. So get with it. You're already into the second half of the year. So I really urge you to absolutely get with that. And the toll-free line is open if you do want to give us a call. And that phone number is 1-866-687-7223. So all topics are available today. We do better with space topics, obviously, and or science and STEM topics. And excuse me, so we're interested in what you have to say. And hopefully the phone will ring, and this won't be a very short-lived open lines program. For those of you insisting on using email today, it is drspace@thespaceshow.com. And again, our line is available, and you can join us. And anything that is on your mind for space or for, STEM or science is fair game. And we want to hear from you. It seems to me that the past week or two has been a little slow with space news, except for the planetary science community, where we've got news on Titan, which I'm hoping to be able to make the subject of a Hotel Mars program on Wednesday evening. We've got news about a triple star planet that we learned about on Friday. And Juno. Juno's in polar orbit around Jupiter right now. It got there, and the orbital insertion was just fine, and all the instruments seemed to check out, and it's working great. And then there was some new information about Dawn, from Dawn on Ceres, right? And some new information that came in the past couple of weeks on Rosetta, which is nearing the end of its life. Human spaceflight? Well, where's the news on human spaceflight? We're waiting. I do have a caller on the line, and let's take the caller. Good afternoon, caller. You're our first caller on Open Lines today, and welcome to the show. And who are you and where are you?
This is John Fort Worth.
Hi, John.
Hi. Well, I've been debating this for a while, but I'm going to get into this subject and see where it goes and whether it's too... anyway, the topic I was maybe going to talk about a little bit is the whole issue we've been addressing earlier about mass, you know, and where it comes from. I've been thinking about the subject quite a bit lately, and looking into some other sources on it. And, you know, we talked a little bit about the idea of mass as being due to the Higgs particle, interaction with the Higgs field, you know, that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
And some of the guests have commented, well, that's really not an adequate explanation, you know. And actually, there's some people that kind of agree with that. So that's an interesting subject in itself. And I sort of got into this, weirdly enough, because I had a dream a few weeks back, well, maybe a couple of months now back. And I remembered something in a book I'd read by Paul Dirac, the physicist, and the next evening I got the book out and looked it up, and no joke, it was in there. And it was kind of along the lines of, this is a very qualitative idea of what it was, it was discussing how the electron moves when he did his theory of the electron, which was one of his big breakthroughs that led to the discovery of antiparticles and that sort of thing. But at any rate, one of the results he postulates is that the electron doesn't actually move at a constant speed in quantum theory. It actually kind of bounces around back and forth at the speed of light, kind of positive and negative, and it averages out to a speed well below the speed of light. Okay?
Okay.
That's kind of weird, right? But you get what I'm saying. But the net effect, the average motion through space is a speed less than light, because obviously it has mass and it can't move at the speed of light. You know, basic understanding of relativity, I think everybody's got that. So, but remember, the idea of the Higgs field was that a massless particle gets mass by interacting with the Higgs field, but fundamentally the electron is actually massless. But it's that Higgs field interaction that holds it back and gives it this kind of inertia, you know. And actually, the real interaction, when I really looked at what it was, I'm not even going to try to discuss that here, but it's a little more complex. But it really is exactly that sort of thing, a continual interaction with a Higgs field, which basically takes something that would be doing the same thing that Dirac had long time before the Higgs field even postulated, and do the same kind of motion. So it's kind of ironic that he got the result without the later knowledge, you know.
But is this accepted as the definition?
Yeah, I think this is pretty much orthodox from what I can see. I'm looking at a bunch of actual physicists on YouTube videos, for example, that try to explain it in detail, you know. And I mean, you know, and they're trying, and I'm thinking, yeah, that's what they're talking about. So it's rather fascinating from that point of view. But the thing is, here's the kicker. If you take most matter, which is the most of the mass of matter is in the nucleus of the atoms, not in the electrons, and the nuclei, you know, protons and neutrons are composed of other particles called quarks, which are presumed to be fundamental according to current knowledge. Okay, and those do interact with the Higgs field, okay? But the mass of the two that are in the nucleons, the up and down quarks, are way below the mass of the actual particle. So most of the mass of a nucleon is actually the interaction through the strong force of these quarks. So it's mostly kind of a form of potential energy, like 99% or 98% of it is just potential energy, basically.
Okay.
And therefore, by the E equals MC squared relationship, it becomes mass. But does the potential energy interact with the Higgs field? I don't see how it does, but this mechanism. See, so that is a very confusing situation, to say the least. But it was kind of thing I've been thinking about, you know.
So what is the significance of this for people who are not quite the physicist that you are?
Well, whatever, yeah. Well, or hopefully some that are better than me will get into it. But it just gets into the issue of is mass due to some kind of global interaction, like your two guests, the one with the Mach principle and the other guy that we just had on the other day there from Britain.
Yeah,
you know, is it really some kind of global interaction, or is it really a subatomic interaction? I think that's...
And for those of us that don't have your physics background, what difference does it make, to quote some famous politician, but I won't scream it?
Well, I think if it's subatomic, then it throws out these ideas of hoping to make a space travel mechanism out of it due to this Mach principle or due to this other thing he's talking about, the wavelength of the, you know, it would tend to go against that. Where if it is something global, then it might be more favorable to something like that being possible. I guess that's the space issue. It would be kind of, you know.
So how do you confirm this? How do you find out which one it is?
Yeah. Well, I think, well, one thing I could say would be to actually do some experimental work, you know, in terms of, like, actually putting the EM drive in space and see if it still produces a thrust or not. I mean, does it actually change, you know, the position, you know, due to that thrust that's supposed to be producing, or does it actually find in space it goes away so we would know it was an anomalous effect? That'd be one practical way. Wouldn't do much about the theory, maybe. Would do something about the practical application, of course.
You know, the guy who is doing a Kickstarter plan to put an M drive in space off the space station, has been in contact with the show and has called the Open Lines program. Did you hear that program? Are you familiar with who I'm talking about?
I don't. Which one was? I guess I missed that one. Maybe, but he didn't
Jonathan
Titus was on, right?
No. He called an Open Line show. He contacted me after the M Drive program. Jonathan Card, C-A-R-D, who I know through the Space Frontier Foundation, is in Maryland, and he's doing. Is he in Maryland or Virginia? I forget. He's doing a Kickstarter to put an M Drive in space via nanoracks on the space station. Just along the lines of what you and the professor were talking about. And I don't know to what degree they're moving forward on their Kickstarter program or when they're going to start their fundraising or anything like that. But and he gave me the name of the organization. I don't remember what it is. But I guess you could do Jonathan Card, C-A-R-D, Kickstarter, M Drive, or something like that. And you'd probably find his website and his program.
Okay.
But he wants to do exactly what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. I think that would be something that'd be really interesting to do that would probably settle the issue, does it work or not, you know. Then if it does work, we'll have a real fit trying to figure out why it works, but I guess the key issue would be, does it, right?
Well, wouldn't that depend on the quality of his experiment? I mean, could he get an M drive up there, but nobody respect it because the experiment or the hardware or something was too amateurish or too junky?
That could be true. I guess the question is how much of a you know, movement, I mean, how much of an acceleration could be demonstrated that it would, you know, can he make it move according to a planned trajectory and bring it, you know, that kind of thing?
I don't know. He's looking for volunteers to help him. You ought to contact him and offer some of your physics guidance and help to make it a better experiment. He purposely said he wanted volunteers to help him with this. This is made to order for you.
Well, it's, I don't know, let me make what I do, but, you know, it is an experimental-type situation, lab-type stuff and all.
Uh-huh. But
I guess the astronauts up there would have to control the experiment, right? I mean, they'd have to be taught what to do with it, and then they'd take it up on one of these cargo missions that go
unless
SpaceX,
they,
I guess. And,
unless they somehow launched it off the space station and it knew what to do on it on its own, and the astronauts didn't really have to tend it, and they were able to get telemetry and information back through some kind of signal or broadcast. I don't know enough about how Jonathan is working the experiment. If you're interested, I'll send you his email after the show, and you ought to contact him.
What he's doing. Okay.
He could probably use your help.
Probably could use some money anyhow.
Well, I'm not suggesting. He said volunteers, so I'm not suggesting there's any money in this. Yeah, I'm sure he could use some money too, but I'm suggesting that you might be able to offer him some really good physics help.
Bad news, I didn't win the big lottery yesterday, so I couldn't.
And nobody did. I checked.
Yeah. So any rate, that's interesting. And the other thing I want to mention about the subject of mass, which is a whole different slant on it, which is kind of interesting. At least it might be to somebody, which comes to going back to some very basic ideas in special relativity, which is that basically, you know, the idea in special relativity is we live in a space-time continuum where we basically throw time in along with space to create a four-dimensional framework, right?
Right.
And so essentially coordinates then basically have four numbers. It's a four-dimensional vector of position, and that's space-time would be. Well, the dynamical aspects of energy and momentum also form a similar four-vector, with energy being the time-like component and then momentum in each direction in space being the space-like component. So that becomes a four-vector, all right? And we form lengths in that arena, you know, sort of like a definition similar to the way we define length in space, except that the way they do it is that time is positive square, and then you basically subtract off the squares of all the space-like things to create something. Well, using that definition of length, if we apply it to coordinate, we have what we have proper time. which is, you know, t squared minus x squared minus v squared, y squared minus v squared. So in other words, it's basically, and what that really measures is the subjective time that something on a, like a spacecraft or whatever flying through a trajectory in space would measure on their own internal clock, the proper time. Well, similarly, if you apply that to this energy momentum vector, the length of that vector is mass, rest mass, if you will. Which I think is an interesting way of looking at that subject. That's really the length of the momentum, energy momentum vector, or vector, is just mass.
You actually have a question from another listener about this.
Uh-huh.
So this is from Paul, who is in Chicago. And Paul says, why in the world, I'm adding some emphasis here, why in the world would you even be thinking about this stuff?
Why would I be thinking?
About mass, I guess.
Well, mass is a very fundamental property of matter, right? I mean, it represents, and we were discussing it originally, that came up on the space show a lot with respect to ideas of Mach thrusters and this explanation of the EM drive, and, you know.
Yeah, this Paul may not have heard any of those recent shows.
And also, the subject in general is a you know, I mean, these kind of thoughts are what did, you know, lead Einstein to the general theory of relativity. You know, he was looking at these kind of issues, you know, back in the day. So it's been a traditional thing, and from my own personal interest, that's something that kind of got triggered again there.
But boy, for you,
I don't know if this is interesting or not. It's a STEM type topic of sorts. But
no, it's fine. I guess Paul, this has been a lot of focus of space show programs, especially I'd say over the last 3 or 4 years. Dr. Woodward or Heidi, we've done 4 shows total with him on Mach thrusters and Heidi. I've done a lot of shows on faster than light travel with credible guests. And breakthrough propulsions with Mark and Eric and others probably go back 10 years talking about these topics and all of this. So, you know, unfortunately, I still haven't learned it. You know,
yeah.
I have a total, you know, this is why you got to commit to coming out to California to go down to Woodward's lab with me, damn it. I'm going to make another pitch. Time is getting short for you to make that commitment and for me to organize it with Jim and Heidi, and nobody else is stepping up to the plate. So it's you who can say, yes, there's something to this, or it's all BS and an artifact of the experiment. You got to do it, John.
Have to come out there.
Yeah.
Now, what do you have any idea which specific days I was looking?
No, I have to contact Heidi if you're willing to do it. I will contact Jim and Heidi and tell them the days I'm going to be out there, and it may be that I have to skip one of the AIAA meetings or something like that. But I'm going to be there Monday night.
Mm-hmm.
I'm driving down, so it's about a 7-hour drive. So I'm going to be there Monday night, and I'm going to come home on Saturday. And I'm saving at least Thursday afternoon and Friday to be with my son, Michael. So
it'd have to be sometime before Thursday evening.
Yeah, so what we did before with Robert was we met at about 10:30 or 11 in the morning, and we drove down to Cal State Fullerton. What we did not know, and boy, this can't happen again because this was a nightmare. I don't think it will happen because the conference is in September rather than August, but they told us to come on a day that they had registration for the first day of the semester. So not only was Cal State Fullerton is mostly a commuter school. So you can imagine the Southern California traffic belt coming into where the university is. And then all of the designated parking spots where we could have parked, we couldn't even get in to search for a spot. And we ended up parking in an offline place about 2 miles away. And then we had to walk quite a bit of a way before we could flag down a shuttle bus and catch a ride up to the physics building. And then, of course, we went out to lunch with Heidi, and then we had the Uber driver drop Heidi off at the physics building and take us all the way around so we didn't have to do that 2-mile walk back to our car. But I don't think registration is in September, so I think we're going to miss that problem. But it would be either a Tuesday or a Wednesday or a Thursday morning or early afternoon. We want to finish in time to head back to L.A. before the terrible afternoon traffic stops. Otherwise, we could be going from Orange County to the Los Angeles area. It might take 3 hours or 4 hours. It could be so bad. So,
Traffic is pretty.
It's just if you happen to hit a bad day with accidents, you know, and stuff like that, or an OJ, you know, chase down the freeway or something, you know, you could figure that you're really going to be screwed. So I would have to find out if either Heidi or Jim is going to be there, and if they're willing to open the lab for us. For all I know, you know, they may have a class that they have to teach or something like that, and they might not be available for us. But I don't want to write her until I know somebody is going with me who can understand what Heidi and Jim are talking about. And
yeah,
that ain't going to be me. It's either you or John Jurist, unless somebody else wants to step up to the plate and say, I'm there, David, and I understand all this stuff, and I'll go down there with you. And I haven't heard from anybody yet. Here, you have another question from Dr. Doug in Southern California.
Okay.
If space-time is a four-dimensional coordinate system, why do we only have three semicircular canals in our inner ear?
Hmm.
Now you got to help me, because I'm not an MD, and I'm certainly not a physicist. So what is the connection with semicircular canals in the inner ear and four-dimensional space-time?
I'm assuming that. Well, that's a good question. I guess the three represents the three dimensions of space, so you can determine motions in space. I guess, or like a organic gyroscope kind of thingy. I guess that's what it does. I guess the inner ear does that kind of thing for you, right? So he's asking why there isn't one with respect to time. I guess is what he's trying to get to, right?
I don't know. I'm asking Doug to give me a phone number, and I will call him on my other line and put him on the line with you if he's where he can talk on the phone.
Time does have obviously time. There is a peculiarity to time that isn't there with space, and that is one aspect of it.
The inner ear is about balance, right? Keeping your balance.
Right. Well, I think he's saying that the inner ear is designed for a three-dimensional spatial orientation issue, and so why is there a time orientation issue, I guess is what that's what I'm getting from that. And, well, I mean, one thing you have to realize is that space does have its own, it has some degrees of distinction there. I mean, for one thing, you can go forward and backward in any reference frame you choose in space, but time you tend to just go forward, right? So that aspect is kind of unique. I mean, you know, that was one thing, you know, the early, you know, relativity theory, you know, they were trying to put them on equal basis, very equal basis, by throwing in, making time be an imaginary number, you know, with the square root of minus one, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
But when they got to general relativity, it obviously fouled them up, because you have a lot of cross terms between space and time. Let's just put it that way. I won't try to discuss the math involved, but it's the off-diagonal elements of the metric tensor for anybody out there that does. You know, so that would, you know, mess them up, because they would become imaginary then, and things, you know, they didn't want to do that, so then they just went to the idea of, say, accepting the reality there is a distinction. The space is, you know, has one signature and time has another, which is usually time being positive and the spatial ones being negative in the length formula.
So can you answer Doug's question?
I think the answer is that the question is you don't really have an issue of orientation and time. You're going forward always, right? So the ear and your inner ear doesn't need to do that.
But you're not always going forward.
In time?
Well, okay, you're going forward in time, not in motion, you mean.
That's right. I guess. I mean, actually, we're going forward in time in a rest frame very fast at the speed of light. That's why time passes so fast, right? But just joking.
I'm deferring to you right now because.
Oh, no, there you have it. I mean, that is one interesting aspect of it too. But
well, if Doug gets my email and he's got a phone line available and he replies quickly, I'll put him on the line with you still on the line.
Maybe he's trying to tweak us here a little bit.
I don't know. He's not replying.
Well, the inner ear is definitely
So if you Googled inner ear and space time, what would you find out?
You might find something about inner ear and something else about space time.
Wait a minute. I may have Doug's email. Hold on. I've got.
But it's okay.
I'll call him and
inner ear.
Yes. Okay. Here. Keep looking. I'm gonna get Doug on the phone.
Feudal games of space and time. Inner ear records. Shingles, inner ear pain, inner ear anatomy and function diagram, space test, Joel's inner ear theory. Now, like I said, it isn't coming out like they're related in any way at all, which is what I was thinking would happen.
All right, hold on. Let me see if I got him on the phone. Hold on. Doug, are you there?
Yes.
Doug, you and John are connected, so you guys go at it, because what's the connection between inner ear and space-time?
Hi, John.
Hi. How's it going?
Yeah, so I was just, it seems to me as though if time is just another type of dimension, it's the fourth dimension, and if the other three dimensions are like 90 degrees to each other, then I was wondering, is time, if it's a fourth dimension, is it also like 90 degrees to the other? Is it also a positional sort of thing? I mean, it seems to me that just by experience, time seems quite different than the three positional directions, dimensions.
As I was saying before, there is a distinction because, you can't just decide to go back in time. Time has a directional orientation to it that spatial dimensions don't, where you have freedom of potential motion and spatial directions in any direction, but time you go forward.
Is that broadly accepted?
Pretty much so. I mean, I would say it is, yeah. If you're talking about theories where you could somehow go backward in time, but naturally things progress forward in time, although the rates can change as you based on relative motion and things like that. But,
So, how about retrocausality?
Well, isn't that generally, that's kind of considered verboten, isn't it?
Is it? I don't know.
Well, there have been people that have played around with some ideas, along those lines, but I think they're not. A lot of people are trying to find out rules of the game where that couldn't happen.
What is retrocausality?
Hawking was trying to do some kind of cosmic censorship hypothesis to prevent that kind of thing. But
what is retrocausality?
Assume something from the future affecting the past, right?
Yeah.
Something from time here going back to yesterday and changing it.
It's like if you break your arm now, there must have been a cause, so it requires that there be a cause, and so.
Well, if you just mean that there was a cause of what led to today, yeah, I think that would. That's okay. That's a little different. I thought you meant actually, like time travel kind of stuff, where you actually have something that didn't happen in the past, and you decide to go back and affect the past.
Well, it's sort of like what caused the Big Bang. If there was no time, before the Big Bang. So there's a theory that, the existence of intelligent people caused there to be a universe in the past, to start in the past, even if it's incredibly improbable that because intelligence exists that can observe the universe, therefore, that causes things in the past to occur.
Mm-hmm. Well, that gets into almost like kind of maybe a philosophical thing. I don't think there's a physical theory that would suggest that. It gets into areas that are kind of more like philosophy, right? I mean,
is there anything in math that would prevent time going backwards?
I mean, not so much math, but the actual physical laws would tend to be against it. There, I think there have been some people, now this is a little bit away from what I know, but I've heard that there were some potential ideas in general relativity involving things like naked singularities, where there's a singularity of a black hole is exposed, but there's no event horizon, and somehow by going in certain directions or something, you could supposedly have something going back in time. However, I know that most of the established, the prevailing view is that the laws of nature are such that that won't happen, that those kind of events are not allowed, right? But
right.
That is, that black holes would never form that way, I guess is what I'm saying, under a real physical process.
I mean, it certainly seems that you get into all sorts of logical problems if you could travel back into time.
Well, one way you conceivably could think of it happening would be if you go into quantum theory, into the so-called many worlds hypothesis. What you might
right.
assume is if you did go back in the past, by going back in the past, you'd be introducing something that didn't exist at that time. So that would create a branch in that world line in which there is something where you did go back in the past. And so the one that the future from which you came from is unchanged, but a new past branches off. It goes off in a whole different direction. Like if somebody went back and prevented the assassination of JFK or something, and then he made a decision about Vietnam differently or what, that kind of thing, you know.
But is this a non-testable theory? Because now you're creating universes which, by definition, you can't interact with because it's not part of your universe.
That's kind of the problem with it, isn't it? Yeah, I kind of agree with that. I don't know how you would test it. And
yeah.
Also, I don't know how you would actually go back in the past anyhow. But if I'm just saying that would be one way of thinking about what would probably happen if somebody found a way where you could, you know. Because otherwise you'd have all kind of paradoxes, like, well, if you went back and
right.
prevented
your
yourself
dad.
Or something.
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
The way Star Trek went back in the past, you don't think there's any plausibility to that?
I mean, by going at the, was it this, going at the, well, which, going, one, which
the, well, they'd,
one,
they'd,
the original
they'd, what,
track? Or,
they'd, go what? To, they'd get up to the speed of light, and then they, what would they do? They'd slingshot back or something backwards?
Well, there you're dealing with a presumption they've discovered science that's beyond what we know involving warp drive, and so if you could really do that, who knows at this point what that would be, you know. That was what they were suggesting. I've never really saw the idea that you would actually go, there's no evidence that, you know, tachyons have been proposed as a hypothetical particle, particles that never go slower than light, but, and of course have never been detected, by the way. Okay, but, yeah, but even those I don't think really truly go back in time, you know, they just sort of always go faster than light, so, but, you know, so I think that's a whole different issue. But I think basically, from what I know, I think we generally go forward in time, and that keeps things well ordered. But you know, there's a lot of mysteries about the subject. I agree with you. Why? How does this work? And you know, there is a peculiarity to time that's obviously not the same as space. You know, that's true.
If time is fundamentally different than the other spatial dimensions, then is there a particular reason why we combine time with space? I mean, why can't we just choose some other dimension and say, hey, that's the fourth dimension?
Well, the reason is because of the properties that you have when you're looking at, like, special relativity about two, you know, objects moving at different speeds and how the time moves differently, you know, for the one that's moving faster and so forth, that kind of thing. The Lorentz transformations do mix up space and time, you know. And
so
essentially, if you look at it this way, in a rest frame, this is a simple way of looking at it. You're moving forward in time at essentially the speed of light, if you will. But if you move in space, essentially what you're doing is shifting part of your motion into space. And since the fundamental speed is the speed of light always, that means you take off some of your movement forward in time to move in space. And so that the total speed, the four-dimensional the magnitude of the four vector still remains the speed of light, but so your speed through time slows down and your speed through space then goes up, if you will. That's that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Which means when you're moving, for a photon, for instance, you're moving at no, you know, you're totally moving in space and not time at all. They're kind of timeless and frozen at that level.
So,
I don't know if that makes any sense. I'm trying to make a simple explanation. It's a fairly simple math, actually. But the conceptually, you can twist your head in circles thinking about it. I'll agree with that.
I'm getting notes from listeners that they are ready to move on through time to another topic. So
yeah. They probably are. This got off in a direction I didn't anticipate, I'll say that. But I was just trying to throw out a few basic ideas. I thought it might be interesting. Maybe other people.
Well, what would be really interesting is if you get your butt down to Cal State Fullerton with me and we go explore mock thrusters together.
So you're saying from Monday afternoon to maybe Wednesday?
No, I think it would be Tuesday through Thursday morning to early afternoon.
And I think
that's like the 14th or 15th through the about the 12th or 13th through the 15th, something like that.
Okay.
I don't have the September calendar. Well, I do have the September calendar in front of me.
Okay.
September 13th, 14th, and part of the day on the 15th. I guess Doug got off the phone. Let me.
If you'd like to.
Okay. So.
Well, we can.
Let me know.
Well, we can converse about that offline. Let people get on with their calls that they want to make. All right.
All right. I'll talk to you later. Bye.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye.
Believe it or not, we are back to normal space-time, listeners, and you can give us a call on our conventional phone line, 1-866-687-7223, and that toll-free line is free. Of course, it takes about 3 minutes for you all to know that it's free because of the delays in streaming and the encoding from the streaming company. If anybody else is planning to go to AIAA and you really understand physics and mock thrusters and stuff like that, let me know. I am absolutely looking for someone to go down there with me. Hi, caller. You're on the space show line for open lines. Who are you? Where are you, please?
Good afternoon, David. It's Michael, listener in New Hampshire.
Go ahead.
I have an update on the Orbital ATK U.S. Space lawsuit that I talked about a few weeks ago on your last open line show on Sunday. On the 23rd, the Orbital ATK filed a motion dismissed to U.S. Space's LLC in New York Supreme Court. Basically what they alleged was that the court had no what we call personal jurisdiction over the lawsuit because the company that U.S. Space and Orbital ATK were supposed to form, Vivisat, was supposedly, according to U.S. Space, a corporation founded in New York State, and that was basically what they were basing their quote what we call personal jurisdiction of the power over the courts, the power the court has over that entity. Essentially, what Orbital was saying in their motion dismissed was that the court had no personal jurisdiction because Vivisat wasn't really a corporation in existence in New York, and it has transacted no business in New York. So because of those because of these reasons, the court didn't have any jurisdiction over it. Now, interestingly, back in May, shortly after the suit was filed by U.S. Space, Orbital ATK filed a similar suit in Virginia State Court, which is still pending. So my guess is until this case here in New York is resolved, we probably won't see any movement on the case in Virginia. But that's kind of a quick update of what's going on in that area.
So basically the case is dismissed because of lack of jurisdiction.
Well, that's Orbital ATK's argument. They filed a motion to dismiss instead of an answer. And basically, I think according to the stipulation in there, U.S. Space has until August to actually respond to that, to object to that motion. So the court hasn't ruled on this motion yet, but that's basically what Orbital ATK is asserting in defense of U.S. Space LLC's lawsuit in New York State.
And your thought as to what's going to happen?
I read through their motion dismiss. I think Orbital ATK has a very solid argument I think it's a very good chance that, you know, that the court will dismiss it because of lack of personal jurisdiction. Then we'll see how the other lawsuit turns out in Virginia, where basically Orbital ATK is saying that they want the court to say, you know, basically look at what this funding agreement that they entered into and say that, yes, we fulfilled our requirements and US Space LLC did not, and therefore you should fine for us. And that would kind of prevent US Space from pursuing any further lawsuits, and it would also, give Orbital ATK any leverage and any potential settlements that might come out too.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's getting pretty interesting. I thought it was really a brilliant move on Orbital ATK's part. You know, the way they framed that motion to dismiss, and also just getting very aggressive and filing a similar case in Virginia State Court.
What else is happening in space law? Anything noteworthy?
Just a space policy issue. A few weeks ago, the RD-180 issue has been put to rest. There was a compromise brokered by Senator Nelson of Florida, whereby ULA can purchase up to 18 more RD-180s, and the Air Force has up until, I think it's December, the middle of December, to actually contract for a launch on aboard a rocket that uses the RD-180 rocket engine. So that one looks like this is something that's not going to be coming up in the next NDAA, and I think we can safely say that issue is resolved.
Okay. Anything else?
Those are the two biggies that I wanted to update you all on, and
okay.
That's all I have.
Thank you, Michael. Appreciate it very much.
Yep.
Bye-bye. So, listeners, the line is available, 1-866-687-7223. And email, of course, drspace, drspace, @thespaceshow.com. So, again, I'll put out the toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. We're due to take a break. I'm trying to decide if I want to see if anyone calls real quickly, or because I've got a lot of emails that came in while the time travel show was going on and said they wanted to get in on the show. So I don't, if a call is about to come in, I don't want to hold it over the break. So yes, here comes a call. Let's see who it is. Good afternoon, caller. Welcome to Open Lines. Who are you and where are you?
Yeah, this is John in Fremont.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, I came across an article on, I think, Mark Whittington's blog, the Curmudgeon Corner, on the nuclear salt rocket, and actually the nuclear salt reactor technology, and I think it may have applications for space, but apparently this technology is really starting to take off again, and there's like four different companies looking at it in North America, and it really has some good safety aspects to it, as well as non-proliferation and some other benefits that are worth looking into. There's an article that Mark Whittington mentions that your audience might be interested in. It's on ZME Science, and it's on if you search on molten salt reactors. The article would come up, and it's
You can send me the link if you have it there.
Okay. Yeah, I'll do that.
Let me see if I can find it real quick. Molten salt reactor. I usually get Mark's emails, but I haven't seen that one come in.
So okay. On Curmudgeon's Corner, it was posted last Tuesday, the July 5th.
Okay, so I've got the one on ZME Science. So, how molten salt reactor might spell a nuclear energy revolution?
That's it. Yeah.
Well, I'm gonna put on my skeptical hat since it has the word nuclear in it.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Yeah.
In these times, you know, it would be better if I could rewrite this headline to say how molten salt reactors might spell a super duper green windmill for energy revolution.
Yeah, that might do the trick.
That might do get the word green in there and the word windmill in there, and nothing else matters, including economics. So, but you put the word nuclear in there, bad word.
Yeah, I know.
Bad word should be in, you know, that conjures up fear for some reason, and you know, most of this is unfounded, in my opinion, although people should rightly be concerned about nuclear issues and nuclear proliferation, but we're not really talking about weapons here. So,
yeah, the history behind this technology is very interesting. They actually developed a reactor for, airborne bombers, and the idea was that, you know, they would never have to refuel, and that went out of favor when they could do when the technology for in-air refueling came along. Obviously, if they can create a reactor for an airplane, they can do it for a spacecraft, and it really, really has great applications in space. So I hope people get over their nuclear fears.
I've wanted to get Kirk Sorensen on the show for years, but he doesn't want to do it. And, you know, I've talked to him many, many times about it. About thorium as well as related topics, and but he just doesn't see any really big point in doing it. But you know, tomorrow I do have Scott Lowther on about nuclear propulsion, and he wants to go back in time to some of the historic testing and advances that were made on nuclear propulsion. So you might go to upcoming shows and post a comment or two to Scott and ask him for his thoughts on this. I don't know if you can listen to the show live tomorrow. It's at 2 p.m. You're probably at work.
Yeah, I am at work. But I'll see if I can post something today.
But I would love for Kirk to come on the show and talk about thorium and some and the salt reactor and some of the other things that he's really known for. But so far it hasn't happened. I don't have any problem asking him again. Maybe I will. When was this article written? If it July 4th, 2016. So it is current. So there's no reason why I shouldn't send this to Kirk and say, hey, how about coming on the show finally and talking about this current article that mentions you in the first sentence?
Yeah.
And see what he says.
Yeah, but it might be worth a shot.
I still have not decided on my ultimate plans for that Ames conference that you and I have been writing about.
Yes.
So I've not forgotten your email, but I'm conflicted with other challenges that I'm supposed to be doing, and which one am I going to take or not take. So that's where I'm stuck at. So I haven't made up my mind yet, but I haven't forgotten to contact you.
No worries. Thanks very much, David, and we'll be in touch.
Okay, anything else?
No, I'm done.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thanks. All right, bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, listeners, I'm going to take a pause for our break, and everybody stay where you are. We'll be back in 3 minutes. It is open line. Your phone calls are welcome, 1-866-687-7223.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, Your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. This is part two of our Open Lines program on Sunday, and it is the 10th of July. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in today. So your calls are welcome, and any space or STEM topic is okay. We definitely would like to hear from you, and our line is available. 1-866-687-7223 if you would like to call. Some additional topics which you might want to talk about was the recent report about Orbital and SpaceX and NASA not particularly doing a good oversight job with the accident investigations for the Falcon and for Antares and the role of NASA. It was a very critical report for both the companies and for NASA. You might also want to talk about the news article that says the Spaceship Two is going to actually start flight tests next month. So that's coming up. And there are approximately 3,600, that's 3,600 small sats that are going to be launched into space over the next decade. How congested is space going to be as a result of that? So who knows? So those are some topics that we could continue to add to our discussion. And of course, anything else is fair game. So we do want to hear you call, and as I said, the line is available, so use it. 1-866-687-7223. Let me tell you a little bit about what we have in store, because there are some pretty interesting shows coming up. So hopefully someone will give us a call, or we'll have a short day. Scott Lothar is tomorrow on nuclear power for space rocketry. Tuesday, remember a couple of months ago, I think it was in April, an article came out about a study on the station about mice showing up with liver problems, and that could be extrapolated into problems for people on long-duration spaceflight. Well, the study authors and principals are with us on Tuesday evening, Dr. Karen, and I'm hoping I get her name right, Jonscher, J-O-N-S-C-H-E-R, and Dr. Virginia Lee Ferguson, and they're over in Colorado. So they're with us about that study. Adam Johnson is back, and he has a second part to his incredibly interesting and cool series of books about 2001. Chris Stone, who is one of our people that we talk to about national strategic expense, space, and deterrent, is our guest Sunday. He has a new book coming out on the topic, and he posted a really interesting Space Review article last week, and that article is in, I put the link for it in our newsletters. So you will find it on the website newsletter and also the email newsletter going out. So as of right now, there is no show next Monday and Tuesday, because I'm headed to a conference on Phobos Deimos at NASA Ames, and again, that's on Monday the 18th and Tuesday the 19th. Now, my plans may change, so pay attention to the Space Show newsletter to see, you know, what happens on that. But that's currently no show is planned. then on Wednesday, the 20th of July, well, that's a historical day, isn't it? So we are doing a show on Wednesday at 7 p.m. with Rand Simberg and Bill Simon, and we're going to talk Evola Terra again for 2016. So those are always fun shows, so don't miss it. 7 to 8:30, Wednesday, the 20th. Richard Rocket returns to the Space Show on Friday the 22nd. So Richard formed the company New Space Global. He wants to sort of be the Standard and Poor's for the new space, commercial space industry in terms of evaluations and stuff like that. So Richard will be back with us again, New Space Global. You might want to ask him how they're evaluating X-Core since they got rid of the links. That might be an interesting question. Guess who is coming to the show on Sunday, July 24th? I'll bet you can't guess it in a million years unless you've already seen the website newsletter. Dr. Jeff Bell is back with us from Honolulu. He is always a favorite. So if you like Jeff Bell and his very sharp tongue, and trust me, it is sharper than a razor blade. Jeff will be with us on Sunday, July 24th. Some other highlighted shows. Let's see. Pat Patterson of SmallSat is back Tuesday, July 26th. Eric Seedhouse is Friday morning, the 29th of July, and this time he's bringing some of his top students with him in, from his class over at Emory-Riddle. The 31st is another open line show. That's Sunday. Cecil Gregory is August 1st. Hey, here's a favorite for you. I know you, many of you like Dr. John Brandenburg. Well, John is coming back on August 5th. He has a new book out. So this is not a sci-fi book. This is a real physics book. So John will be with us on August 5th. That's Dr. John Brandenburg. Another favorite that you like, Dr. Zubrin, Robert Zubrin, Bob Zubrin. He is back on Tuesday, August 23rd. And let's see, Grace Wolf Chase, who is over at the Adler Planetarium at the University of Chicago, she is a guest for the first time about Adler and the Chicago Planetarium. She is our guest on Friday, September 2nd. No show over Labor Day holiday, and then we don't do any programming while we're at AIAA, which will be the 12th, 13th, and 16th of September. But I probably will do some interviews at AIAA, and we'll play those, possibly get them up and running by Friday, September 16th. And Zimmerman, another of your favorites, Bob Zimmerman. Not the political commentary Bob Zimmerman, but the space news guy and the space book writer and the new space promoter, that Bob Zimmerman. He is back with us on September 27th. We have a caller on hold, and good afternoon, caller. Who are you? Where are you? And thank you for calling.
This is Doug from Southern California.
Hi, Doug.
I was holding it back a little bit because I thought you'd indicated somebody was wanted to call in. But
well,
I
think they may have called. That may have been John, who called toward the end of the first segment.
Oh, okay. Okay, very well. Well, I wanted to share a couple things. One is, remember Mark Raymond?
Yeah, of course.
So he's a principal investigator, is it, for the Dawn mission?
Right at JPL.
Yeah. So I've been periodically in touch with him by email, and there was a news report just last couple days saying that they have they're sort of describing cold traps on Ceres, and it turns out just I think like with the Moon, with Mercury, and now Ceres. Is that as long as you don't have too much of a tilt of the axis, that there is permanently shadowed craters at the poles. And so I think that with their sort of topographical mapping of Ceres, that they are identifying locations that they have not detected water ice at, but they believe that these are permanently shadowed craters. And so I think there's a fairly good chance that that there will be ice there.
And the what's the significance of ice on Ceres? It's pretty far out there. Wouldn't you think there'd be ice there?
Yeah, but apparently there's not ice on the sun-exposed surfaces. You got to remember, when you have ice in the presence of vacuum, any little amount of energy, you know, from sunlight is going to cause it to sublimate, basically go from solid to gas.
To gas, right.
Yeah. So I sent him an email. I said that I was excited to read about the cold traps in Sirius. I was wondering if there was any instruments that could confirm ice in those locations. And I didn't quite clarify, but I meant instruments on the Dawn spacecraft. And then he actually responded, and I think he would be fine with me reading his response. I says, "Hi, Doug. The cold traps are pretty interesting. We cannot confirm ice in those locations because of the very nature. They are not illuminated by the sun. Nevertheless, we are searching for ice with the infrared spectrometer. It won't be able to see into deeply shadowed regions, but it could, at least in principle, find transient ice if it is on the surface before it sublimates. Also, we use the nuclear spectra to find concentrations of hydrogen, indicative of water, most likely in the form of ice. It does not have adequate spatial resolution to peer into specific cold traps, but already has indicated that higher latitudes likely have ice closer to the surface than lower latitudes." I wrote more on this in the March issue of Dawn Journal. And what this is describing is, I think, very much like we have on the moon, where high latitudes showing a hydrogen signature, and then with the L-cross results, they confirm that there's ice in the permanently shadowed craters. So it seems as though whatever we do with the ice on the moon, we might be able to do a similar sort of thing when we eventually get out, you know, as far as Ceres.
I think he's ready. He may be ready to come back for a show update on Ceres and Dawn.
Yeah, we now know about the white spot on Dawn. I think
the bright spot. Yeah.
Yeah. What? Unfortunately, it's not ice.
What is the latest on the bright spot?
I forget. It's not. They were thinking maybe it's Epsom salt, magnesium. I think it's magnesium sulfate. But I forget. It's some salt, like aluminum sulfate or something like that.
I think I'll see if Mark wants to come back on during August. I don't have any real times left in July, but that would be a good update. I'll tell him you strongly urged him to come back on.
yeah, exactly. And I'm actually looking at a news report. They say yes, it's salt. Let me see if they have identified the type of it. More. Yeah, they've got now really high resolution. They actually see sort of a collapsed dome in the center of this thing. It's been fun watching it just get better and better resolution as it gets lower and lower to the surface.
Interesting how they can tell that.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing.
So just real quick, I can't see if they've identified the specific type of salt.
Doesn't say doesn't say Morton any place on it.
No, iodized salt.
That's right.
Let me just, I've sort of been wanting to mention this, and I don't think I've discussed this before. I've thought about the issue of dust mitigation. And I think this would be especially the moon, but also on Mars. And it seems to me, as I've sort of systematically thought about it, I don't think there is one solution to dust. But I think a set of solutions for the different specific settings can go a long ways to addressing the issue. So I think the dust is a problem with landing and taking off. It's a problem by getting the joints of telerobots. It's a problem with EVAs, and it's also a problem if you're trying to grow food in the dirt, whether on the moon or Mars. But I think that there is maybe some fairly straightforward solutions for many of these situations. For the landers, I think that one of the first things that could be discharged from a lander would be like a landing tarp that telerobots could secure, and then future takeoff and landings could be, you know, at that specific location. And so that'd be a very quick way of being able to keep the dust from blowing, you know, all over the base. And then sintering, you know, using microwaves to basically melt, could extend the landing area, and also could be a pretty straightforward way to create paths, like between the landing area and a base, to keep it from, you know, not being dusty as people travel back and forth. Rattel robots, you know, when Greg Baer was on the space show, he mentioned that, you know, they deal with dust all the time, really abrasive stuff. And he said that they are quite, you know, experienced in mitigating dust. So I think what we've done in the mining field could be applied. But you can also do things like simply operate more slowly so you're not, you know, wildly kicking up dust. And all sorts of local, you know, immediate things of having protector, you know, sort of shielding from dust, as well as sort of sealing things, sealing joints so that dust can't get in. My thought for EVAs, which is, of course, a big problem with Apollo, is, you know, the suits were not designed to address dust, and then they went outside and got very dusty. And so I think that, to a large degree, we should, you know, look at staying indoors, because you got your radiation protection and you can avoid dust if you stay indoors, and use your telerobots as much as possible and only go out, when needed. And then if you go out, like in a rover, NASA does have these, sort of backdoor suits that you could be able to, leave the spacesuits on the outside. And I've also heard a discussion of using coveralls as a way of having a dust protector away from the actual spacesuit itself. And then also on the one of the rovers that, you know, crewed rovers that NASA has developed, they also have this little glass bubble out in the front so that you don't actually have to get out of the EVA, out of the rover. You can drive right up to a rock and use some manipulators to go ahead and sample rock. You don't even have to get out of the vehicle to do that. And then for gardening, I really think you can do a lot with hydroponic, in which it's a dirtless, you know, dust-free sort of approach to gardening. And I really think that, you know, in the movie The Martian, the idea of him getting his hands dirty in that toxic soil, probably not realistic.
Have you seen dust mitigation strategies on any NASA or ESA type of websites?
I haven't. Well, I mean, I've seen where they, for example, the suits that back in so that they leave it on the outside.
Yeah, they're testing
one example,
kinda, right?
But I have not seen. I haven't even looked for it. To see if they, as a category of problem that they're trying to mitigate.
They probably are. It would be interesting to see what they're coming up with.
I'm just Googling here. They're discussing electrostatic approaches. Yeah. Scientists developing dust mitigation for...
Is there somebody running that research at NASA? That'd be a good topic for the show. Does it say, is it a special department or something?
Yeah, I might, my internet connection here in the canyon is not real good. I'm seeing one, Space Environment Effects Dust Mitigation Technology. It's PDF, so it's probably a scientific paper, which would have a principal investigator. Oh, okay, here's something interesting. Electrodynamic dust shields, and there, it looks like they're testing on one of these vomit comets. Yeah, I can look into it and see if
there'd be an interesting if somebody was like coordinating this kind of research or something. Like, it'd be interesting to talk to that person or people in that department.
Okay, here's a name. Here's Carlos Calle, Calle, lead scientist in Kennedy's Electrostatic and Surface Physics Lab. He says our laboratory is now developing electrostatic dust shields to prevent debris. I just cut out here.
Okay.
From accumulating on various surfaces. It seems a little limited.
Well,
very narrow.
The field may be limited for right now. I don't know.
I mean, it'd be nice to have somebody who's, you know, covers all of those areas.
Well, if you come across someone like that, let me know. I guess I could ask Julie or some of my contacts if there is someone overall in charge of or doing that kind of research. Of course, she, even though she's worked for the station, she might know people doing that.
Well, here's a nice money quote. When activated, Kaye said, 99% of the dust was removed from the surfaces protected by the dust shield. That's nice.
That's nice, yeah.
Yeah. I'll do a little more looking around.
Are you planning to go to Long Beach for AIAA in September?
Yeah, I'm hoping to present an article with Jim Wirtz.
That's right.
Yeah.
Are you going to be there for all the days, or how are you going to work that?
Yeah, I'm going to take time off work and be there. I've got a Space Colonization Technical Committee on Tuesday night, and then I'll be there probably through Thursday.
Okay.
So depending on when I present, I might take a shift Monday or something like that.
All right. Well, I look forward to seeing you down there.
Okay. Yeah.
All right.
And are you for sure going to the PhD conference, the Phobos Deimos conference?
I'm enrolled. I'm not for sure going. Are you?
Yeah, probably not. Is it too late to enroll?
Probably not. It's a freebie at NASA Ames, so I doubt that it's too late to enroll. And there's a website on. Do you have their website?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
I would have to switch a work shift date with somebody.
I never even got an acknowledgement to my registration, so I'm assuming I'm on the list. I think you have to go to the visitor center and get a pass to go to where they're having it, as I recall. But
is it behind the wire? Do you have to be a U.S. citizen?
Well, I think it's in front of the wire, except they said on the thing it said directions. You have to go into the visitor center at the gate and get your credentials and pass. So something like that. Unfortunately, it's sitting on another desk in my little studio room, and it's not where I can go get it real quickly. But I do have it. So I don't know why you would have to do that if it's in front of the wire. But
right.
But as I recall, it said you had to park and go get your credentials in the visitor center. But I could be wrong on that. And again, I never even got an acknowledgement to the registration. So I'm assuming my registration was confirmed, but I didn't get anything from them. So I don't know. Maybe it's just kind of loosey-goosey. I really don't know. Oh, great.
I'm guessing we're actually going to see a Phobos, you know, either Phobos or Deimos mission before we see people landing on the surface of Mars, unless, you know, if in terms of NASA doing it.
Jim Logan and Dan Adamo get upset because NASA, to their perspective, has a total focus on Phobos, and they sincerely believe that Deimos would be a lot better location for a whole variety of reasons, and they don't understand the continued NASA focus and dismissal of Deimos. They focus on Phobos. So when I asked them if they were either one was going to be at this, they said no, because it's just going to be more, you know, Phobos-only stuff, and they're sick of it, and they weren't going. So that's kind of the response I got. So I don't have any firsthand experience at this event, so I really can't tell you.
I'm advocating a combined Phobos and Deimos mission, because the delta V between them is so small that I think if you leave a mothership in a highly elliptical Mars orbit, then from a mass standpoint for propellant, I think you'd actually do both. I think that I'm not real excited about low latency telepresence for science.
They are, as you know.
Yeah, I know. And what's his face with FISO? He's also very strong on that.
Harley.
Thronson.
Thronson. Yeah.
But I think if you do the math, I don't see how a few humans on Deimos or Phobos beats multiple low lower cost landers in multiple remote, you know, locations on the Martian surface far from each other, which you just can't do otherwise.
Well, so. They certainly disagree with you, and I don't have any plans to do a resurrected program with them on this subject, but you know, their paper, the Aquarius paper, is where they lay all this out, and they're still promoting that very strongly. So they obviously disagree with you. And listeners, if you don't know what we're talking about, you could Google Jim Logan or Dan Adamo, ADAMO, and you'll see them on the program together last year talking about their Aquarius project, and that's what we're referring to.
Yeah.
And you, and I don't think anything's really changed. They told me they were trying to be more specific about the potential benefits of using water as a fuel. So if you remember, there was a big dispute about the numbers they were using for nuclear propulsion using water, and it turned out that they were making up the numbers in order to be as an example, and they got called on that. And so now they're trying to determine if they can come up with real numbers for using water as a nuclear fuel for real ISP rather than something that was made up to be used as sort of a role model idea, not as something specific and final. But that was an interesting discussion because that information was made up in their report.
Well, they sort of made a guess, so I guess you could
That's a better way of saying it. I agree with you. It was an educated guesstimate.
Well, I think they sort of took an average, and I think when you calculate the ISP, you're not it's more sophisticated than just an average. But I mean, sort of as a starting point, maybe it wasn't too bad. I think there was more work that they needed to do there.
Well, they're trying to do that more work now and to get a better handle on water.
It's just, I mean, to put a nuclear technology development project on the critical path to going to Deimos, to me, I think, I just don't think it's probable that that's going to happen.
No, I agree with you. And well, I don't think as long as you use the word nuclear, anything is going to happen. I think you, as I said, and maybe you call it green supercharged windmills, and you might get it to work.
Yeah, I mean,
what is that noise?
The wow. ISP of solar electric propulsion is higher than you know, nuclear rockets, so it does take longer. But you could push it all the way out to either like EML2 or a highly elliptical Earth orbit, and use a small chemical push to send you towards trans-Mars injection.
We're getting some interference on your phone line. Do you hear that?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, some kind of high-level buzzing. I think you've been tapped by the National Security Service.
Anything. Anyhow, let me go ahead and free up the line in case somebody else wants to call.
Thank you, Doug. Appreciate hearing from you. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Listeners, we're still doing open lines, and we'll keep the show open if you want to give us a call about any space topic or STEM topic you would like to talk about. Nobody wants to talk about that Washington Post article on vision problems. I hope some of you will post a comment on the Washington Post article and then tell me about it so I can direct listeners to it. You know, especially those of you who dismiss these articles and these medical research issues and just believe we need to take the risk and go. That's who I really think ought to be posting the comments. 1-866-687-7223. Also, I would have thought some people listening might have known Molly McCauley and would have wanted to call in and comment about her and the horrible circumstances of her dog walk Friday night in Baltimore, but maybe they're not listening to the show today. I don't know. She's a very popular lady and very well known in the space community. Anyway, our line is available, 1-866-687-7223. The Phobos-Deimos conference is at NASA Ames. For those of you that are in the Mountain View Silicon Valley area of California, and you have time on Monday or Tuesday or both to go, and it is a freebie. All you have to do is register, and I should have brought over the documentation to this desk. I can't really get up and go get it. We'd be sitting here with maybe 30 seconds of dead air time, and I don't want to do that. But you can register and go. So if you're in the Bay Area and you want to go to it, and it's got great people there. Pascal Lee, for example, is one of the coordinators of it. And there are others that you've heard on the space show and that you know, and, you know, just from your advocacy or your work. And I think it'll be a really good plus experience. So I totally recommend it. And if you go, I want to hear from you. Because I'm planning to go, but I may have to change my plans. I mean, some personal family stuff is on the horizon here, and I don't know if it's going to conflict or not. But I am planning still to be there, and so let me know. I'd like to meet you. Now, I drive down to NASA Ames, so I'm not staying there at night, which puts a burden on me in the evening and the early morning hours. So I usually get to these events a little late. And then I either have to leave before the traffic starts. I mean, I'm telling you, the traffic going northbound through San Francisco is like nothing. Well, I shouldn't say that. Any major city has bad traffic, especially if there's an accident or something like that. But it's really horrific. Elon Musk, hurry up with your Hyperloop. That's all I can say. But anyway, or I stay down through dinner and then come back later in the evening. It's about a 90-minute drive for me if there's no traffic. So if you are going to be at Phobos Deimos, Doug, you're going to be there. I'll certainly look for you, and we'll meet up and chat. But I don't commute. I don't stay down there because I just soon do the 90-minute drive. And so that's my plan right now. And if you're going to be there, I certainly would like to meet you. And as I said, it's a freebie. High-quality people are going to be there. And if you're in the area, it is absolutely worth attending. If this topic interests you, Mars, Phobos Deimos, it's about human spaceflight mostly, too. I think I was... I did tell you about some of the shows coming up, so I do want to stress again that Jeff Bell's coming up pretty soon. And Bob Zubrin is coming back. I don't have any other phone calls, so and nobody is bothering to send any emails, so I think I'm going to call it a wrap. So if you want to get in on open lines, and you need to hurry up and do so, and I'll give you the number one more time. 1-866-687-7223, and we'd love to hear from you. And you know, I'll see if somebody wants to call over the next minute or two. And I don't know, we're not hearing anything about space in the political campaigns, and I'm not surprised at that, but this is a big but. And don't think I'm advocating one party or one candidate or the other. It's just something I'm going to point out. You know, there is talk that in Trump's campaign, he may pick Newt Gingrich as his VP. He may not, but there's a lot of talk about that. He has also said that Newt, if he's not the VP, will play a role in his administration. So Newt really is pro-commercial space. And he's very, very knowledgeable about space, despite his stupidity and his blundering, foolish comments that he made in the Republican primary in 2012 in Florida. So that is something to keep in mind, whether, you know, he'd be good at what he does. You know, he's 74 years old. I can't tell you. I mean, I'll leave that up to you. But I do know that he has really good space credentials for new space and commercial space, and he's got very good contacts. I should say new space has very good contacts with him. Let's see. Trump also has some senators involved with him that are very pro-space, but traditional space, not not necessarily commercial or new space or not known for that, but more or less known for traditional aerospace. So, and I haven't really heard anything about Hillary and Laurie, because Laurie's also got the credentials for commercial space and new space. So, but I haven't heard anything about that. But I've seen press on Newt and some of the senators. We do have a caller. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is John again from Fort Worth.
Yeah.
Well, I just noticed that comment you made about the Aquarius project. I was the one that, of course, pointed out the issue of the specific impulse.
Well, I mean, yeah, that was, and they didn't want to modify their paper to show that they were using guesstimates, because they presented it, as I remember, as actual data, and I think that's where both you and Jim Doerr, who was also there, you know, were very critical about that. But I had discussions with him later. I said, look, guys, amend your language to say that this is a guesstimate and don't mislead people. But they didn't want to do that. I thought that was very strange.
Yeah, because it is an idea. I mean, I thought of that idea myself independent, you know. Well,
what, water is nuclear fuel?
Yeah, well, because obviously it's much more storable. I mean,
right.
You could use ordinary liquid water as a propellant. I mean, that'd be just great. It's highly dense. It's not toxic, corrosive. Well, it's not. You know, I mean, it's,
and you can drink it.
You use it for shielding too, one way. But
right.
That, all that good stuff. But yeah, but the problem is you have to actually get the temperature so high to separate the two out.
Right.
You know, the oxygen from the hydrogen. Yeah, and then you have the problem that the hydrogen still retains a atomic weight of 16, which is still, you know, not much better than. And then you get into the question of how the two average together, you know, between the monoatomic hydrogens. I guess they'd be monoatomic at that temperature, you know. And the problem of nuclear propulsion has always been the issue of the materials that can take the temperature sufficient to really get the propellant to the temperatures you'd really like to have it, you know, and that's the big, big bugaboo with it. It's and why we almost always go back to liquid hydrogen, you know, which is
which is
a molecular weight of 2 and is, you know, pretty high specific impulse.
Well, I was told that they're working on refining their water as a propellant discussion, and I think that's great, and I'll be interested in seeing what they come up with, and I'll probably have them back on the show to talk about it when they, you know, publish an update or however they're going to do it.
Interesting to see how that turns out. I hope they bring some, like Jim Doerr or some other propulsion type specialty people into it that have the credentials to really authoritatively say these things, I guess you'd have to say. But
it's all speculative because nobody's done it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you get to ultra-high temperatures, which would require, I mean, it wouldn't be, you know, first-generation stuff. I mean, this idea has been tossed around in the past. I looked for the book and never could find it even on some of the websites. But apparently it was some book where somebody addressed this idea back in 1965 once. But the problem, again, is, you know, there's issues of things like, you know, gas core reactors and really ultra-exotic nuclear, let's call it, you know, as opposed to your solid core, which we have a historic experimental work in great detail on it, Jim Doerr's documented
right.
In his books. And that stuff is really exotic, you know what I mean, especially when you consider the materials you're working with, gaseous uranium. I mean, that's you see the problem is the materials that can hold those temperatures, you know, to get that, to really break the molecule. With water, you're still left with something at a molecular weight of 16. With that monoatomic oxygen, is still 16, which is pretty high, you know.
Absolutely.
And that's not only a little bit less than 18 for the water molecule, you know. So that's the fundamental problem with that. But it's, anyway, I just thought I'd make a comment on since the issue was addressed, to refresh everybody's memory what the issue was.
It was a real interesting, and in a way, it was a showstopper discussion.
I'd hate to do that, too.
You know, I compare that discussion to the very, very classic when Pooley was going after John Powell on orbital airships to orbit, and telling them they couldn't get the energy and everything to get going, and Pooley was giving him all the facts and everything, and it was brilliant. And John Powell acted like he didn't even know what Pooley was really talking about. I mean, that was a classic space show, kind of not a debate, but a sort of a space show pull the plug on the guest program. You know, that only Pooley could pull off, given the way that Charles behaved and what he was like.
Well, I hate to be a wet blanket on the concept, but like, it is one I'd looked at myself. Earlier, I mean, I remember one time years earlier, I was going, oh, water, that'd be cool, you know? And then I went through and did the calculation and went specific impulse at about 300 versus 900 for hydrogen, you know, or proportional as you scale it up, and I went, oh.
So
that's in the range of chemical propulsion, like hypergolics, you know? That's.
So Doug has an email for you. Hydrogen has an atomic mass of 2 if it is in the diatomic form. If we could break it into its monoatomic form, could we double the ISP?
No, it would be the square root of 2, 1.1415 times the ISP.
It would not be doubling it.
It'd be the square root of the amount, yeah. And that's,
So it's not as much.
Not as much, but it's a big improvement. If you can do that, you know, you still have increased it by more 41%, you know.
Uh-huh.
And if you go, that puts you up to, what, 1,300 or something with the current temperatures. But the problem is, to get to that, to break it apart, you'd have to go to higher temperatures, so you'd even have more impact from that.
Why can't you, why is it the square root of 2?
Why is it the square root of 2? Let's see here. Why is it? Because, okay, you get into some equations there, but basically, basic Newtonian energy for a 1/2 mv squared equals some constants times absolute temperature T. Okay, so when you increase, okay, so but the mass, okay, is on the other side. So the mass, move the mass under the T, the velocity, take the square root to get velocity, then it'll be square root of T over m. Okay, so as the mass gets, you know. So the mass goes with a square root, like the temperature goes with it too. So
there was a reason I didn't take physics in school.
So it's a fairly simple calculation, but and it's established. Any book on propulsion, you'll see that. You know, I mean, and that's that deals with those topics, and that's why it becomes a very difficult subject, because the materials. See, the way the chemical rockets, like hydrogen and oxygen rockets, can get a better specific impulse is they have convection cooling. You know, of the propellant taking the heat out of the nozzle, you know.
Uh-huh.
And you also keep it cool because you run the propellant through the inside of the nozzle and heat it up, you know, and take temperature. So that keeps it from melting. If it wasn't for that, the thing would melt at the temperatures otherwise would be present. But given the coolant, you take the heat away there that way with the propellant.
But you don't do that with nuclear power.
Well, you do it the same thing with nuclear power. But but you have to run it through the core to get the propellant up to the temperature. There, you're not just using it to cool; you're actually using the core to heat the propellant. And so, the result is that you have to have the temperature you want to get the propellant to. You have to have the core at. You see, so and the question is getting materials that can just take that temperature and also withstand the pressures and the potential erosion of the propellant flow going through it. I mean, Dewar was mentioning that some of the early experiments, they had trouble with the idea of it tending to want to blow the core right out the nozzle. And so there's a whole lot of issues to make the materials strong enough to handle that and be able to take the temperatures that you need to have to get the specific impulse that makes it worthwhile. Which comes down to the fact that you want to have some of very low atomic weights, and so hydrogen becomes very preferable, although it's bulky as heck and very lacking in density and deep cryogenic.
So Doug sent in another note. He says the square root of 2 times SSME ISP 453S comes to 641 seconds.
For Mean compared to what's the
SSME? Okay. I guess he means the Space Shuttle main engine.
Yeah. Right. Well. Yeah. But okay. That would be well. But here we're talking about the specific impulse of something like the Nerva nuclear rocket, which is around 850 to 900. Okay.
Right.
So if you could magically break that into monoatomic at those temperatures, you'd get something more like 1300.
Right.
I haven't got a, you know.
But I remember that was a discussion with Jim. They were getting like 1300 or 1400 ISP, and
yeah.
And you and Jim Dewar were, and even Jurist was in on that, were saying how, and they kept challenging their water analysis numbers, and then we found out that it was just a sort of a guesstimate for demonstration purposes about
yeah.
their paper.
So it's yeah, exactly, and that's
it wasn't real. There was no real history of anything like that using water as a propellant.
Well, that's one of the things, you know. I mean, you have to. It's one of those things where you kind of do a check, you know, like why did the people in a extremely expensive multi-year program like NERVA choose something like hydrogen? There was a reason they did it. It wasn't because it was easy. It was because of what was necessary to really get the advantage of nuclear. Because otherwise, you're dealing with something that's in the range of conventional propellants, like particularly hypergolics or kerosene oxygen, you know.
Uh-huh.
And so in that case, why go nuclear and have all those environmentalists go wacko on you, you know?
Correct.
But if you can get to those high ranges, you know, then it becomes worth maybe the political battle if you can win it. Because
well,
you get, you know, so much better.
I think it's more about winning it politically than it is on engineering or even cost-wise.
No, I mean, you can make a NERVA-like rocket. I mean, I think that's well within our capabilities if you get through the political
battles. Yeah. Well, we'll
go to the next level is a whole different issue, but, you know.
Well, we'll hear more about that tomorrow with Scott Lothar again.
Yeah. Okay. I thought I'd go through that a little
yeah,
bit.
If you can,
the topic
if you can,
came up.
If you can listen tomorrow, it's 4 o'clock your time, 4 to 6, 4 to 5:30
okay.
your time.
And he's talking nuclear, right?
Yeah, nuclear. He's going to be glowing the whole show. Absolutely.
Okay.
Talk to you soon, John. Thank you.
Okay. Right.
Bye-bye. So, listeners, that's close to a two-hour program for Open Lines, and we're probably going to call it a day unless somebody gets in real quick on the toll-free number, which I'll give out real quick just to entice someone who wants to make an 11th-hour phone call, 1-866-687-7223. Otherwise, we're going to shut down and say goodbye and... you know, the upcoming shows are listed on the website. I'll post the website newsletter in a little while, and you'll get the 6 a.m. California time email newsletter in the morning. It's all set to go. And we're ready to start another week on the Space Show. So I hope everybody has a great week and, you know, keep it safe. Have a good rest of the weekend. And as we like to say, keep looking up. And again, the show today is in memory of our friend and former Space Show guest, Dr. Molly McCauley. And may you rest in peace, Molly, and may the son of a bitch who murdered you be found and appropriately prosecuted. And I hope your dogs are in good hands. Everybody, thank you for listening to the Space Show and for participating today. Goodbye from myself and all the callers and the emailers and the participants. Again, have a great week. Keep looking up.